There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning. But since dinner...
Those were the opening lines of Jane Eyre, which Charlotte Bronte published under the pen name Currer Bell in 1847. She died less than a decade later, did not get a write-up in the New York Times, though her name and work are well known over a century and a half later. And then, more than a century later, there was poet Sylvia Plath with the same treatment. But have you ever thought about why the motorcycle queen of Miami never got a New York Times obituary? After all, Bessie B. Stringfield was riding Harleys in the 1950s, something that women just weren't doing back then. Her legacy was major enough that she was inducted into the Hall of Fame of the American Motorcyclist Association in 2002. That was nearly a decade after her death in 1993. We're talking about the New York Times History Project. It's called Overlooked. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The goal is to add the remarkable stories of women who never received a Times obituary at the time of their passing. Amy Padnani came up with the idea for the New York Times Overlooked series. She is a digital editor for the Times obituaries section. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you tell us those early thoughts about how you came up with the idea for this project?
Sure. I joined the obituaries desk a little over a year ago. It was January 2017. The national debate on race was heating up, and so was the conversation about gender inequality. And I'm a woman of color, and I had started getting involved in some diversity initiatives on a personal level. But I also thought, as an editor at the New York Times, what could I do to help advance this conversation? People were coming out of the shadows to tell tales of injustices that they faced, and it really resonated with me. So I had this in the back of my mind one day when I was doing my day-to-day job. I was researching a possible candidate for an obituary. It was a woman in the tennis world, and I came across a website describing Mary Outerbridge, who is credited with introducing tennis to America in 1874. And I thought, wow, I wonder if she ever got a New York Times obituary. Who would have thought a woman introduced tennis to America? So I checked in our archives, and spoiler alert, she did not get a New York Times obituary. So I put this in the corner of my mind, and as I did more research and came across more names, I started keeping a list. And I began to tell my colleagues about it, and they were really intrigued. They suggested other names, and this list grew and grew. And so finally I thought, what should I do with this?
And it was major crowdsourcing at the Times. People working across all divisions were coming to you, apparently.
Yeah, once this project was in motion and they heard about it, people were so excited. I think about 50 writers reached out and said, can I write an obit? And we had a team of editors sitting in one room. They plowed through about 30 of these in the span of a week. It was really an amazing effort how many people stepped up. I also partnered with our gender team, our new gender initiative. So they also helped out a lot.
What's been the most surprising thing about working on this series for you? How has it changed you?
Oh, that's a nice question. You know, it was really surprising to see the feedback or the amount of feedback. I knew this was impactful, but we had a form to gather reader submissions, and we got something like 2,500 responses within the first few days. And I walked into work that day and had 87 emails from the moment I pulled up my inbox. And normally I have 87 emails and most of them are deletable, but this time 80 of those emails were congratulating me, which I thought was, you know, really heartwarming. And a lot of them were from my colleagues around the building. Some of them were other people of color who said, wow, you know, I never would have thought a person of color could achieve something so great at the New York Times. And it meant a lot to me to feel like I could be an inspiration to them.
How do you decide who to include in this Overlooked series?
So we follow a similar process that we do now when we decide who will get a New York Times obituary. Generally speaking, if the person had made news in their lifetime, then chances are their death is news as well. With some of these women, that should have been the case, like Sylvia Plath. With others, maybe they should have gotten news for what they did in their lifetime. And so we kind of think of it that way. What sort of mark did they leave on the world? Did it change society in some way, or did it change things for a large group of people? And if so, then we think they're worth a New York Times obituary.
And we also have Nikita Stewart on the line, your colleague, a reporter at the New York Times. And Nikita, you wrote about the Motorcycle Queen of Miami. Can you give us an introduction to her?
Sure. Bessie Stringfield was this phenomenal woman who rode motorcycles at a time when many women were not doing so. And also to see a black woman doing what she did was amazing and inspiring to a lot of people. To this day, there is a kind of cross-country trek of women who get together, and they call it the Bessie Stringfield Ride. So you had this ride named after Bessie Stringfield, and we didn't really know who she was. So it was an honor and a treat to dig into who she was.
And the pictures that you find are, to me, also just what is so enriching about this project. And her picture, so proud next to her Harley, it was so cool.
Yes, she apparently owned 27 Harleys in her life. She rode even before the 1950s, in the 40s, in the 30s. And, you know, I'm explaining to people, you know, folks get upset about a pothole, but, you know, she was riding on unpaved roads and in rural areas where she was not always welcome. And she managed to do it.
And Nikita, how did you get involved in the project? Did you bring her to the table?
No, Amy found her and said, you know, would you be interested in writing an obituary? And I was like, sure. And she was like, how about Bessie Stringfield? And I said, okay. And I had actually never heard of her. But then when I started doing research, I was like, oh, she's all over the place. And especially in this age of social media, people tend to, you know, turn people into symbols and put them in their Facebook feeds and on Twitter and on Instagram. And so there was a lot circulating about her. So it was great to find her kind of an accurate story about her.
And Amy, how did Bessie Stringfield get on your radar?
So she was suggested to me by another editor at the New York Times, one of the people who was mining and looking for interesting candidates to write about. I'm looking at the spreadsheet right now. It was suggested by Monica Drake, who's a masthead editor here at the New York Times. And under the notes field, somebody wrote, yes, cool story.
And that's really all it took for you to dig a little deeper.
Yeah, really. You know, I read about her. I went around, you know, to different websites. I talked with our research desk, and they pulled up some information about her, and she seemed like the real deal. So, but Nikita Stewart then called me a few days later into her research, and she came across something really interesting that, Nikita, do you want to tell me about the discrepancies that you were coming up with?
Sure. You know, Bessie Stringfield had become such a kind of icon that her story wasn't exactly true. The stories that were on the internet and also, you know, in a comic book. And, you know, she was a woman of mystery, and she was originally from North Carolina, but she told people that she was from Jamaica and that she was born to an interracial couple and left on a Boston street by her father, and her mother had died, and she was adopted by a very nice, rich white woman who gave her her first motorcycle when she was 16. That was her story, and she stuck to it. But, you know, now we have access to census records. Everything is just more readily available than it was in the 1990s and 1980s when stories were being written about her when she was still alive. And so I was able to find some of her relatives, her nieces and nephews, who are still living, and they had fond memories of her when she would whirl into town to Baltimore and put them on her motorcycle. And she also performed in carnivals, and she could do all of these fantastic tricks on the motorcycle, like standing and riding at the same time. I can barely ride a bicycle, so that's pretty amazing.
So, Nikita, those investigative skills, you could crack her story more readily and perhaps help set the record straight in this obituary, in this tribute.
Yes, and I felt good about that. But then I also wondered, I'm like, oh, my goodness, would Bessie hate me if I revealed her truth? But I think she might have gotten a kick out of it. And her nieces and nephews, they didn't know how, you know, great she had become. I guess it's one of those things where you don't think, should I put in my long-lost relative's name in the, you know, on the internet and find out, you know, what's out there about them. They never even thought about that. They're in their 70s and 80s, so they never did that. And now they know that their aunt became this, you know, great figure in Miami, leading motorcycle clubs that were all men, and riding in a parade every year where children looked up to her.
And Nikita, writing this obituary is far afield of what your daily beat involves. Was that a breath of fresh air for you, perhaps? More of a creative outlet?
Yes, although I tend to work on stories that are can get very complicated, and they're investigative. So I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to write this obituary. I mean, I've been a journalist for a long time. I've written obituaries before. But, you know, writing these obituaries, it's very difficult because they've been deceased for so long. So it's not like you can dial up you know, a best friend, because the best friend has usually died too. She actually had an obituary in the Miami Herald, and I started with that, and everyone in the article was deceased pretty much.
And Amy, going back to you, you know, at the heart of this, at the root of this, is a history project here. And to a degree, you are setting the record straight for these women who have been overlooked. So how much does that influence what is written about these women, the facts about their life?
How do you mean?
Well, because, I mean, you could look at it from the political approach as to, you know, why they were left out. You could also look at what their contribution could have been or what it means to society today. You could look at it as to why perhaps they're more significant now than they were at the time of their death.
Sure, yeah. I think that is one of the things that makes this so fascinating, is that we can now talk retrospectively about their impact in the decades since they died. So a good example is Marsha P. Johnson. She was instrumental in the activism at Stonewall, which a lot of people credit for the gay rights movement for starting it. And she was such a fixture of Greenwich Village in New York City in her time frame. So people knew her, but at the same time, they didn't know what sort of impact she would have down the line. So I think that, you know, now we can really see that. And you know, another name for this project could almost be hindsight, because there's so much more that you can include that you wouldn't have known when they died. And in fact, some of the bigger name women who I found did get New York Times obituaries were presented in such odd ways. Susan B. Anthony was described as having a pleasant face. Frida Kahlo was described first as Diego Rivera's wife, and then second as a painter in her own right. We would not write these obituaries this way now if we knew about these people. So it's very strange looking back at how things were done.
We're talking about the Overlooked Project at the New York Times here on the morning show. Looking since 1851, obituaries in the Times have been largely dominated by men, and that's being kind of turned on its head with this new history project recalling the lives of people who have been overlooked in the Times' obituary section. The journalists who are working on the Overlooked Project stay with us. Amy Podnani is the digital editor on the obituaries desk and founded the project. A New York Times reporter, Nikita Stewart, has contributed to the project. She had the most recent piece in the collection on the motorcycle queen of Miami, Bessie B. Stringfield. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What women do you think have been overlooked? Who deserves a belated obituary to celebrate a life well lived? Is she a famous woman, a household name? Who should get more credit? Or is she a woman who personally inspired you or made you think about the world in a new way? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network.
Tulips are too excitable. It is winter here. Look how white everything is. How quiet, how snowed in.
You just heard poet and author there, Sylvia Plath, reading from her poem Tulips. Plath is one of the most famous poets of all time and did not receive an obituary in the New York Times when she died in 1963. The project is calling out literary giants, these women who are literary giants. They were civil rights icons. They pushed boundaries, upset cultural norms. The goal of the Overlooked Project is to spark more conversations about diversity. We're talking about the New York Times History Project Overlooked in this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The founder of the project is with us. Amy Podnani is the digital editor on the obituaries desk. And New York Times reporter Nikita Stewart has contributed to the project. She covers social services for the New York section. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think about obituaries? Does everyone deserve an obituary, or should we reserve them for only the most exceptional people? And what effect does discrimination or prejudice play in who is remembered and whose name never makes it in print? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy, let's look a little bit more about Sylvia Plath there. We just heard Tulips. You know, what about Sylvia Plath made it into the Overlooked series?
Well, I think it was kind of a no-brainer, actually. Mm-hmm. So that one was suggested to me by the head of the obituaries desk, Bill McDonald. He had put together a compilation of New York Times obituaries in a book called Book of the Dead in, I think, 2016. And when he was doing his research for Book of the Dead, he came across some names of people who didn't receive obits that really surprised him. And Sylvia Plath was one of them. So when I was describing this project to him, he sent me a list. And there were some other interesting people on there that we may consider exploring. Franz Kafka never got a New York Times obituary. Emily Dickinson, but she wasn't well known until long after she died, so that's kind of understandable. And there were several others, so, you know.
Do you think it's possible in Sylvia Plath's case that it had to do anything with her suicide?
I had wondered that. You know, I wondered if we had a policy against obituaries for people who had committed suicide, because Diane Arbus was another one, and I think a couple of other
photographer
package. That's right, the brilliant photographer Diane Arbus. And it turns out, no, we never had any policy against obits for people who committed suicide. So, you know, it's really confounding. I mean, we could only guess what was going on at the time if there was a newspaper editor who didn't think these people were important enough, or if there was too much breaking news that day. You know, we didn't always have a dedicated obituaries desk, so we relied on each individual section to write their obituaries, and maybe it just was overlooked.
Let's bring in a call now. Eugene is joining us from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good morning. I'm wondering if you were included, you ever got any, you included in your list Jefferson Davis's wife. She's born 1826, died in 1906 in New York City. She led an interesting life during the Civil War and also after the war, pretty much.
So the New York Times began publishing in 1851, and we're only looking at people that we would have overlooked. So if we, so anybody who died before 1851, we didn't include them.
Eugene, thanks so much for the call. Let's bring in Beth in Milwaukee. Beth, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I was just curious if you had ever heard of a woman named Jacqueline Cochran. I did a research paper on her ages ago, and I believe she was the first female pilot to break the sound barrier. But her biography or autobiography was extremely interesting.
That's really interesting because we recently had another obituary on pilot who also broke the sound barrier later on. I will have to look into her. She sounds fascinating. I'm not sure if she got a New York Times obituary, but I'll have to check our archives. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Beth, thanks for the idea on Jacqueline Cochran. Amy, why are obituaries important? What can we learn from them beyond simply what they tell us about the deceased person?
I think what people love the most about New York Times obituaries is that they feel like it's a mini history lesson. They're always learning something new about something that affects their day-to-day life but they never thought about. You know, recently we had an obit for the guy who invented the wetsuit, and it was because he was a beach bum, and he said, I wanted to surf year-round, and I couldn't do that because it was too cold. So, and nobody thought that somebody actually came up with this idea. We had an obit for the woman who invented the self-cleaning house. Everybody would love a self-cleaning house. So, you know, and it was fascinating. She was frustrated that cleaning was considered a woman's chore, and she said, no, that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to have the house clean itself. So I think it's just, they can be really whimsical and fun, oddly enough. I mean, obituaries are really not about death. They're about life and all of the things that people can accomplish in their lifetime, or, you know, not even for fame, just for their own well-being or for a group of people around them for the betterment of their lives. So I just think it's really interesting to see that, to see what sort of impact people can leave on the world. I think that makes it very relatable for readers.
But as you crunch the numbers, still in current times, in the last 2 years, you still are very underrepresented in the women who make it into the obituaries.
Yeah, you know, it was something that came up shortly after I joined Obits a little over a year ago. I saw some notes from readers saying, hey, why don't you have more obituaries about women and people of color? And I thought, yeah, why don't we? So that's when we began crunching some numbers, and we looked back all the way to 1851, to the day when the New York Times began publishing. And since then, about 15% to 20% of obituaries were about women. It kind of fluctuated up and down. In the last 2 years, it's been about 20% or 21% of our obituaries are on women, which is, you know, really disappointing. So we are trying to think of ways to change that going forward. Overlooked is fantastic to begin the conversation and to look back and give people their due, but we have to fix this problem. So we're looking at other ways that we can do that.
There are a couple in the series featuring women whose accomplishments are historically important, but whose names really fly under the radar, like Ruth Wakefield, who invented the chocolate chip cookie, Alison Hargreaves, who is this first woman to climb Mount Everest solo without any oxygen. Do you think these women could or would have been better known and remembered if they had been men?
That's a fair question. I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure if there was some sort of bias happening when they died, or, you know, some of these women died in complete obscurity. There was Nella Larsen. She was a literary star of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1930s, and she wrote these books that are still discussed in classroom today about what it's like to be a middle-class black family in dealing with racism around you. And when she died, she had stopped writing for decades, and she died alone in her apartment. Her body was found days later. Nobody really knew who she was then. So it's possible that some of these people just sort of faded from the limelight and the New York Times editors at the time didn't really know who they were. But, you know, we can only speculate.
And Nikita, as you have written these obits, you have written obits in the past. Does a project like this influence your day-to-day work?
Oh, I think it does because, you know, like Amy said, obituaries are not about death. They're about life. And, you know, I'm from the South where you always say, you know, give them their flowers while they're alive. And so, you know, I guess I do look at people a little differently in now looking at all of the overlooked stories. It's just, I don't know, this has just been an inspiring job, if you will, because, you know, people of color and women, we have to remember, are also often left out of history books. You know, there's always been a debate about what should be taught in the classroom, and it tends to be very male, white male-centered. So I think a lot of obituaries, not only in the New York Times, but throughout the country, are influenced by that.
And Amy, you might be able to see overlooked permeate in other ways as the series goes on, you know, through history books and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, we're expanding our lens beyond women to include other overlooked groups of people like men of color and others. So today we just published our latest one. It's on a husband and wife team of Chinese architects. They mapped out China's history through the lens of architecture, crawling into these, you know, dusty corners in ancient temples, coming out with bugs all over them, and there are bats everywhere. And they said, "This is great. We learned so much. This is the best day of our lives." So they were really passionate about this endeavor. So that included our first man in the series, and we will be incorporating other overlooked people as we go on.
So this was a husband and wife team. When did they die?
Let's see. I don't know off the top of my head. It is on the New York Times website now, so I could check. But they're a husband and wife team of Chinese architects, and in fact, the wife, she was not allowed to get an architecture degree because women were not allowed to work late with other young men unsupervised. So her husband got the degree, and they were able to study and do everything together, fortunately. So their heyday was in the 1930s. She died of tuberculosis in 1955. He died in 1972.
And how did you go about finding them and their story coming to light?
They, I believe, were suggested. No, actually, I came across a story about them in the New York Times archives. It was a story about a book that they put together. And it was the book looking at the history of China through architecture. So I just thought, you know, that sounds so fascinating. I don't remember how I came across that story. Sometimes I just dig through our archives because it's fun for me.
Right. Amy, millions of people die each year. Very few, select few, have, you know, a New York Times obituary. Can you give us a window into how the Times chooses its obituary subjects today?
Yeah, it's really a complex process. I think something like 150,000 people die from one edition of the newspaper to the next. And of those, we hear about a paper-thin slice of them. And of those, we have to pick three. We have three writers. So it's a really tough process to have to decide. You know, you really have to think about which people your readers want to hear about. So, you know, we have a meeting every day where we look at a list of candidates. We hear about people through reader submissions. They email us. They call us. We look at the wire services, other news websites, social media, And we compile a list of people that we look at every day in our morning meeting, and we talk about them. We say, well, what was this person known for? Were they the first? Or, you know, was there something particular about them that somebody else did, who did that similar field did not achieve? Some of them are no-brainers. Recently we had the woman who was credited with inventing the sock puppet.
Mm-hmm. So, that's awesome.
You know, and she was the patent holder, so that was like, we have to do this. You know, in other cases, it's a little, you know, it's not so clear. So we discuss them and we do our research. We look back at old Times coverage or other newspaper coverage. We'll ask our research desk for help. We'll read other websites about them. Sometimes we'll talk to people who knew them to decide whether they're worth a New York Times obituary.
And you're on a pretty strict deadline there. Time is of an essence to get these obituaries out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the news hook is that they died. And the longer you wait, the more stale that news becomes. So it's a rigorous daily process for sure.
You're also looking at so many people coming at you saying the words first and only, first and only. And from the journalism world, we always shy away from the words first and only because you always get that sense that there's someone else out there who did that. So you also have to reckon with that.
Yeah, we do. We always talk to each other, you know, beware of superlatives. So we really warn each other, remind each other about that and question each other and question our sources to say, how do you know? And if there's a reputable place like a Hall of Fame that credits them, then, you know, we feel a little safer. But we do our due diligence to make sure of that if we're going to put that.
Obituaries in the New York Times have long been dominated by white men. Going back to the start of obituaries in 1851 there at the Times, now the paper of record is really trying to refresh the record, bring to light the remarkable contributions of women over time. We're talking about the Overlooked Project on the morning show. The founder of the project, Amy Padnani, is with us. She is the digital editor on the obituaries desk. And Nikita Stewart is here as well. She's a reporter for the New York Times covering social services section for the New York section. And she's been writing as part of this series. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who deserves an obituary in your mind? How do you think about obituaries? Does everyone deserve one, or should we reserve them for only the most exceptional people? What effect does discrimination or prejudice have on who is remembered and whose name never makes it into print? And have you ever crafted an obituary, perhaps for a family member or friend? How did you decide what events or accomplishments, what anecdotes made it into the write-up? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. The New York Times is making an effort to reconcile for many decades of historical and perhaps journalistic oversight by publishing belated obituaries of groundbreaking women whose deaths were not marked in the newspaper's obituary pages dating back 167 years. They published well over a dozen of these tributes: Ida B. Jones, Charlotte Bronte, Sylvia Plath. Talking about the project here on the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And even today, the Times obituaries desk notes a troubling statistic. Just over 1 in 5 of obituary subjects have been female in the past couple years. The founder of the project, Amy Padnani, is with us. She's the digital editor on the obituaries desk. And Nikita Stewart stays with us. She is a Times reporter and has contributed to the project. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you read the local obituaries? Have you discovered something unexpected about a person you thought you knew? Maybe you've read about someone you wish who would have a chance to get to know through obituaries. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Mark now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My comment was, you know, my wife just wrote an obituary for her father who died, and he was kind of a kind of a big deal, you know, teacher in a small town. What about folks in larger, you know, cities that kind of go unrecognized?
Good question. Amy or Nikita?
I think it's about finding them. You know, as we sit here and talk about how people were overlooked, I think it's amazing that there were submissions of like 2,500 in 3 days, because obituaries are also about word of mouth. And our obituary staff, you know, it's pretty small. And I imagine at all, you know, regional papers and local papers, it's probably one person. So it's a matter of people reaching out to the Times and letting us know about people in smaller communities who might be overlooked. So I'm glad we're having this conversation.
Amy, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, you know, every single person that comes across our desk, we look into them. So, you know, which is a lot already, but we don't want to miss anybody important. So I agree. That's absolutely it. That's the best way that we hear about people is when we get phone calls or emails describing them.
Mark, thanks for the call. Earlier, we just skimmed over photographer Diane Arbus, who became famous for taking pictures of marginalized people and even just people caught looking bizarre, strange, a giant next to his regular-sized parents or circus performers. Let's listen to a clip of her.
Everybody has that thing where they need to look one way, but they come out looking another way. And that's what people observe.
Take us into her life, if you will, Diane Arbus.
Yeah, she was actually quite wealthy and privileged, and she decided to photograph people kind of on the margins of society, dwarves and others, circus performers, transvestites, mentally disabled people, people that you wouldn't normally think about as part of humanity. And so people kind of question what she was doing. Is she kind of doing this for attention or exploiting them? Or is she really just drawing attention to these groups that were not normally thought about? So it was kind of fascinating what she did. It was groundbreaking in a lot of ways. And these portraits that she did were just so beautiful. So, yeah, as we said earlier, she committed suicide. She was only 48 years old when she died. But she suffered from deep depression.
Let's go to Clyde now, joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was listening to the program, and my brother was included in the New York Times obituary list, and I didn't realize what a selective process it was. He died in 1988. He was a composer of children's music for piano teachers to use, also for Barnum and Bailey Circus, Captain Kangaroo. And he was worldwide famous, but we got obit copies sent to us by other people, and we said, well, that's nice, but we didn't realize how intensive the search had to be to get on that paper. It was really nice.
So, Clyde, he had worldwide recognition for his composition work for children's music?
Yeah. The one he missed out on, he interviewed with Walt Disney, and Walt Disney was ill at the time. And Lynn never had a copy. His name was Lynn Freeman Olson. He was world-renowned. He left a piece of sheet music with Walt Disney. Walt died and never got back to him. 2 years later, his music surfaced from the Disney studios without his name on it. And It's a Small World was his piece of music.
Wow.
You can't go to Disney World without, and it's public domain forever. Disney studios said it will never be copyrighted, but I just want to say thanks for bringing this program to air. I was enlightened by the special nature of making the New York Times.
Well, Clyde, thank you for bringing the story of your brother as well. You know, Amy, do you come across people who have more of a worldwide presence that you know, you would be able to then say, of course, this is a person we want to write about?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, definitely. I think actually we maybe didn't focus so much on international candidates in the past. You know, there was a time, especially a century ago, where we were very New York focused. Mm-hmm. And the obits were almost like society pages. It would be, you know, the banker's wife died, so she gets an obit. And she would be Mrs. John Smith or something to that effect. It wouldn't even be her name. It would be her husband's name. So things have changed a lot, and now we are looking more at international figures. We have bureaus all over the world that we communicate with, and as one of my initiatives to try and get more women and people of color in our pages, I've been reaching out to our foreign correspondents. There are eyes and ears in the most far-flung parts of the world, and I say to them, if somebody important dies in your region, please let us know.
Mm. Nancy from Milwaukee called in to ask if Anita Shreve, an author who died last week, is being considered for a New York Times obituary.
Actually, I believe she got one.
Excellent. I don't have access to check it right now, but that was Nancy. So Nancy, take a look, do some more. She did get one apparently. So thank you for that call, Nancy. And what is it like to write obituaries about people who die a long time ago? And what's it like to write obituaries that defy the form in that the death isn't the news anymore because it's been years, decades since the subject passed away, sometimes even hundreds of years, over 100 years since they died. Nikita, could you go start with that?
Sure. One of the things with Bessie Stringfield is that her, she had an impact when she was alive, obviously, but her impact has gone on through the years. Like, she never knew that a ride was named for her, hundreds of women who look up to her are on these motorcycles riding across country and sometimes doing it the way she said she did it, which she would, flip a coin, and wherever the coin landed, that's where she would travel to. But, I did talk to some women who, were influenced by her but had never met her. So, that's fascinating to me for folks to look up to someone who they never met, who, is deceased, and they just admired them and they try to emulate them.
And Amy, you're not on such a tight timeline here when the time of death is not part of the news peg. What is the difference here with this series as you write conventional daily obituaries?
Yeah, we're relieved that with these we have more time because the research is so involved. Day-to-day obituaries, it's true. We don't get as much time. You're really pulling together what you can. We have very experienced writers on our obituaries desk, so they're able to pull something together quickly. But, they talk to family members who are in the middle of grieving, and it can be really a difficult process. I think you have to almost be part therapist in a way and, repeat back what you're hearing and show sympathy and, understanding for what the person is going through. One time I wrote an obituary for a sculptor, and I was talking to his ex-wife, and she and her husband had only divorced a year ago, and I said, oh my gosh, this must be so tough for you. And she said, it's like I'm reliving the whole thing just by talking about him. So, people are going through all kinds of things when you're working on obituaries. So it's a tough job. You really have to, I think, want to be an obituary writer.
Let's bring in John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Yeah.
John, go ahead.
This is Tom from Burlington.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were John in Milwaukee.
We had someone die here in Racine. Mrs. Johnson died. They owned the Johnson's Wax, and she was a wonderful lady, and she got a huge write-up in the New York Times obituary thing. She died last month, and a fantastic woman, and we're very happy that you did include her in the New York Times.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much.
Well, Johnson Wax, they're a local company that has strong roots in Wisconsin. So certainly eyes are on who the New York Times sees as deeming worthy of obituaries. And Amy, I'm sure you do feel that pressure of making those tough decisions, making those journalistic calls.
Yeah, it's not easy at all, you know. Luckily, I have a team of editors working with me, and we all bounce ideas off of each other. And, you know, I think the more voices, the better. That's part of the reason why we were so excited to get so many responses in our reader submission form for Overlooked. We got about 2,500 replies in just a few days. And really, everything in life is improved when you have more voices. And I think that's the case for the selection process as well. The more different, sort of diverse group of people who come to the table and question each other, the better. So that's sort of how it is. It's really tough, but, you know, you just have to evaluate every aspect of a person to decide.
Let's bring in Jim now in Eau Claire. Hi, Jim.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I have what I consider kind of an odd pastime from time to time. I read the obituaries regularly in our local paper, and some of them at this point in my life are old friends and so on, but I became very interested in the description of how the operative verb, if you want to put it that way, of how people die. They don't, most of them die or pass away, but many of them are written by relatives or in some even by the deceased themselves. But I have about close to 1,000 now different ways. The heavenly angels came down to bring him home. The Lord called him up. He was called home for Christmas. He shed his earthly bonds. He slipped away quietly and peacefully, returned in many different, sailed on, an old Navy man, mounted his horse and rode away. And I mean, it's just very, very descriptive. And then in the course of the remainder of the obituary, you have all these, great things that people did that are for normal, that you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, he was born in this tiny little burg, and look at what he or she was able to do, many of them for women.
Well, Jim, we are really short on time here, and I want to get Amy and Nikita to respond one last time. Amy, go ahead.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny about the flowery language that people use when other people die. We do try to stay away from some of that, you know, that kind of funeral home language, which is, you know, nice. But here we are a newspaper, and it's essentially news that we're covering, and the person's death is news. So we you know, we don't look at the obituaries as, you know, as a tribute. We look at it as though we're really, you know, telling readers about something important that they want to know.
Well, Amy Padnani, thank you so much for joining us. And Nikita Stewart, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Amy Padnani is the founder of the Overlook series, and she's digital editor for the Times Obituaries section. Nikita Stewart, a reporter for the New York Times covering social services for the New York section, and rode through the Overlooked obits on the Motorcycle Queen of Miami we heard about earlier. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this conversation on Overlooked, you found it on the Ideas Network.